What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the show. Before I kick it over to Nick for an intro, this podcast, I guess the impetus or the reason for this podcast, I made a reel, and I'm speaking directly to you too, Nick. Made a reel about, what's her fucking name? Steak and Butter Gal's blood work. And, okay. You know, she had made a reel about, hey, I was vegan, this is my blood work. I went carnivore, this is my blood work. Naturally, her LDL went through the roof through that transition. And, you know, obviously no mention to some of the stuff we're going to talk about now. I made a post being like, hey, like, we're not really sure that's a good thing, let's just say. And it for my size of an audience, air quote, blew up. And 99% of the comments were, as comments go, like, wildly unproductive. But there were a couple of people bringing up what we're going to talk about today, lean mass hyperresponder context. And the irony is, like, when I was having this discussion with people in the comment section, I was privy to your Oreo paper. I read the Oreo paper. We're going to talk about the Oreo paper. But going down the rabbit hole, realized that that was somewhat a tip of an iceberg, that there was quite a bit more. And the irony, like, I couldn't help but think, why haven't I come across that research? Not that it's my entire job to be reading literature, but it is something that I do as part of what I do. But I was very interested. I'm sure you, listen, I just find that it is interesting that it hasn't made its way to the, let's say, non-low carb community. And I think that that's an interesting conversation in and of itself, why some of what you guys are doing is is not necessarily being discussed. I would say, like, by people like me. I don't want to do that as if I'm speaking for other people, but I find that to be quite interesting. And I'm really happy to talk about it with you today. Really excited. I spent the last week reading every single word of every single paper that you guys have been putting out, and find it incredibly intriguing stuff. And so super pumped to get into it. Why don't you give people a background as to who you are, how you became so interested in this topic, and obviously went on to research this topic.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jordan. So for my background, my academic background, I did my undergrad at Dartmouth in cell bio and biochemistry before going to Oxford to do my PhD in metabolism, before going to Harvard to do my MD, where I am now finishing up my final year of my medical doctorate. Now, along that journey, like, I always knew my whole life I wanted to do science. I wanted to be a physician. In fact, I grew up in a household with two MD PhD parents. Like, medicine and Western medicine is not foreign to me, and I hold the highest respect for Western medicine. Now, that said, along my journey, I was struck by my own health issues, the centerpiece of which was inflammatory bowel disease, specifically ulcerative colitis. It really took me out of commission starting at the end of college and really at the beginning of grad school, where I had a precipitous decline in health and quality of life. I went from being a competitive athlete, marathon runner, calisthenic athlete. I had, like, push-up records, and I was a high-achieving academician. Actually, I was the valedictorian of my class. To being someone who could not cope with basic, like, intellectual work because my brain was all fog. I was physically frail, like, you know, dropped to below 100 pounds because I just couldn't keep anything in. I was having bloody diarrhea 20 times a day. I was in ICU level care, palliative care. I remember just spending days at the John Radcliffe Hospital in the NHS near Oxford, just, like, in bed, exhausted and so tired that getting up and going to the bathroom literally felt like marathons used to. So over the course of a couple of years, you could see my health just plummeted. And bear in mind, I had access to the best medical systems, or presumed to be best medical systems in the world, and had intellectual and familial resources that gave me every single opportunity to access the top that Western medicine has to offer. And we can do some amazing things with Western medicine. Not knocking it. We really can, like, do some pretty incredible things. However, when it comes to chronic metabolic diseases, including things like inflammatory bowel diseases, I think Western medicine misses the boat on the fact that we don't tend to address metabolic health conditions with metabolic health interventions. We can dig into why that is, because it does have to do with more than just people liking pills, for example. It's all about the research infrastructure, what evidence we have, why it's hard to conduct certain studies, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact of the matter is, I personally got to that point that a lot of patients get to, which is extreme desperation. And when you're desperate, you will try anything. So I started trying anything, and I tried every diet you can imagine: low FODMAP, specific carbohydrate, paleo, vegan, vegetarian, pescatarian, yada yada. Eventually, I tried a ketogenic diet. I was incredibly skeptical, but I had nothing to lose. And phenomenally for me, my inflammatory markers dropped along with feeling so much better. And then the next time I got a colonoscopy, I was in biopsy-proven remission. So that is my personal foray into what I consider metabolic health. I like to be transparent about it because as much as I like to say I can separate, my practices and my health from my interpretation of the literature, none of us are completely unbiased. So that's my story. Take it for what it's worth. But when I did cut out carbs and go keto, my LDL went through the roof. On a mixed diet, it was in the 90s. It had never been high. When I went keto, my first blood test thereafter, my LDL was in the mid to high 300s. And I will emphasize, I am not steak and butter gal. I am not chugging, or I wasn't chugging butter and eating lots of red meat. In fact, I wasn't eating basically any red meat or dairy, because what I thought was healthy was I'm like, I can, find the overlap in the Venn diagram of presumed to be healthy and ketogenic. So I was eating salmon, avocado, lots of olive oil, lots of fiber. That was actually sufficient to put me into remission on a ketogenic diet. We can get to that in the juxtaposition of a case series we just wrote on a carnivore diet for IBD, different topic. But bottom line, my diet looked, if you looked at my plate, like the canonical healthy diet. You can Google my name, and we have a cookbook me and some friends put together, and it's like Mediterranean style keto. That's how I was eating. Nevertheless, my LDL did go through the roof. And for me, while that was scary at the time, this was in 2019, it was also thought-provoking, because it's like, I'm looking at my plate, I'm looking at my labs, what's going on here? And so that's what really drew me into the metabolic health space, long story short. Obviously, there's a lot of dominoes to fall after that, but I tend to be long-winded, so I'm going to zip it and throw it back to you.
No, that's good. That's good. Yeah, funny. I also nodded along with just your experience. I, at some point, I don't know, 2015 maybe? I don't even know anymore. 2016. Spent an entire year in ketosis, went keto, and I probably had one meal for my future brother-in-law's birthday where just had a maybe a dessert bender, but other than that, 365 days in keto, pricking blood every day, just and what we can, it's not about my story, but also have a blood work analysis from that time with an LDL of like 375. And I can't really say that that was independently a reason for me ultimately shifting back to a more balanced approach, but yeah, I have that same scenario of being, what I would have from the outside looking in deemed metabolically healthy, fit, athletic, training in the gym, doing sports, whatever, but also having an LDL that looks like something serious is going wrong. So, absolutely understand that experience and have seen that as well. So, what I'd like to do is for the listener, we're going to be talking about LDL cholesterol, ApoB, and its risk factor for heart disease given specific populations. And Nick has done a lot of research on a specific population that we're going to talk about in a second. But I'd like to almost set the scene a little bit with, I don't want to say a traditional approach, because it's not, you're not actually discounting what we're going to talk about as far as the lipid hypothesis, but I'd like to set the scene with, what is the lipid hypothesis? Let's define LDL and ApoB, and let's talk about their role as per the lipid hypothesis in the development of heart disease as we know it.
Right. Because that's such a big topic, I want to focus on defining LDL and ApoB, those two big players, and then just really getting people to understand what causal means and what it does not mean. Because I actually think, like when I've observed, I think that is a nucleus of confusion on both sides. So let's unpack that. So LDL and ApoB. LDL refers to lipoprotein particles. So the cholesterol that's circulating around your blood can be on different particles. It can be on the HDL family of particles and the LDL family of particles. Now, LDL cholesterol is the cholesterol carried by those particles. Hopefully that's clear. And ApoB is the apolipoprotein on that LDL lineage of particles. There are other particles that include ApoB in different forms of ApoB. We're talking about ApoB 100. A little bit of nuance there, but thing, there's Lp(a), yada yada yada. But for the sake of simplicity, we're talking about, we have LDL particles, and ApoB is a measure of the number of particles that are around. And those are presumed to be, quote, atherogenic, contributing to heart disease in a causal manner. Now, what is meant by causal? Causal means, as I would interpret it, and I think it's pretty straightforward, it's part of the causal cascade of development of plaques in coronary arteries. What I want to distinguish causal from is important. Now, I'm not saying ApoB and LDL aren't important, but causality is not a measure of importance. At a very high level, right? If you have a causal cascade and you want to undermine the endpoint, you could address any point in the causal cascade and hopefully reduce risk. So that is true. Like all things being equal on a population level, you reduce your ApoB and your risk of cardiovascular disease will go down. But there are added layers here in a real-world setting. First of all, the absolute risk is context-dependent. So even if a one person with a given ApoB is at a higher risk than they would otherwise be with a lower ApoB, if that risk, that absolute increase in risk, is very, very small, then it might not be that important to address as compared to other factors. And it's also important to consider when you're doing an intervention to lower LDL and to lower ApoB, it's basically impossible to hit one biomarker in isolation. So there are going to be other things you're modifying. If you're modifying diet, for example, let's take my case as an example. If I came off keto, my LDL will go down. I've shown that before, even with Oreo cookies. But I would then be at high risk for ulcerative colitis flares, going back into the ICU, being inflamed, my quality of life would tank. The chronic inflammation would probably increase my risk of colorectal cancer. Like there's a lot of trade-offs there. So I think it's important when we talk about ApoB and this idea of you hear, quote, lower is better. It's with respect to what? And let's say, okay, cardiovascular disease. And then what is the absolute gain from reducing it? And how are you reducing it? And what are the trade-offs there?
Could I poke into that just real quick? Because I think
yeah, go ahead.
As a general understanding of that there are trade-offs and compared to what and at what cost. And we're looking for net positives here. Everything is about an increase in net, you know, net health. The common interventions that one might suggest for lowering ApoB are ones, not all, but the ones that jump to my mind are ones that you would also nod along with. They're like, yeah, those are probably a good idea anyway, you know. And I'm not saying you would agree that those are always a good idea for everyone, but we're talking about, you know, getting to a healthy body weight. We're talking about improving, you know, building muscle, improving cardiovascular health, maybe potentially eating more fiber, maybe potentially lowering saturated fat, maybe, you know, lowering refined sugar intake, maybe. So, you know, talking about it being a net positive, are there, you know, you're kind of posing the question of like, okay, but there might be a cost to some of these things. Most of those, to me, at least for a discussion today, sound like, yeah, those are actually net positives, period. They're going to come with other actually really good stuff. It's not so much that they're going to be good in lowering ApoB, but bad for something else. They sound generally like they'd be good for other things too.
Generally. So I think it's important not to conflate what might be like the average good advice for the general person and the general population, and then for a given individual. And this is where I think people get hung up on our work, because I come to this from the angle of a scientist, where some of the work we're doing, it refers to a particular population, but a population that I think reflects truths about underlying human physiology that are best demonstrated by looking at an extreme, which we do all the time in medicine. Talk about Brown and Goldstein, won the Nobel Prize for studying really what's a 1 in 1 million genetic condition. So just because something's rare doesn't mean it doesn't have something to teach us. And in studying this lean mass hyperresponder phenotype, which we'll define, you are presented with what appear to be paradoxes. So you were talking about, for example, healthier interventions probably leading to better cholesterol metrics, or presumed to be better cholesterol metrics. Well, then what do you do with data when I say, okay, if you have a lean mass hyperresponder and they get more active, they do more cardio, their LDL goes up, versus being sedentary, their LDL go down, or even Oreo cookies, their LDL goes down. There's a juxtaposition of what's presumed to be an unhealthy intervention and a, quote, good outcome. And I think that's what I'm poking at more from a scientific perspective, obviously not putting any value judgment, or at least good value judgment, on some of the interventions like, say, eating Oreo cookies. But in there lies a truth, I think, which is looking at cholesterol, including LDL and ApoB, as a litmus test of good overall health can be problematic. It would tend to trend on a population level on a mixed diet with better overall health. But if we can say there are circumstances where that rule breaks down, then it means that we have more metabolism and physiology that remains to be understood. And that is my goal. Like we're going to talk a lot in this podcast. And what I want people to really keep in mind is that there are two conversations happening. These are four fingers, but two conversations. One is the scientific, where I'm going to, wax eloquent about metabolism and what's going on. The other is the clinical. And I'd like to parse those things because I can get animated and ask questions that are legitimate scientific questions. And at the same time say, but given the limited data, from a clinical standpoint, it's important to take as conservative a stance as is appropriate for your setting, your individual setting, and that is a discussion for you to have with your physician. So in general, people shouldn't be getting their health information off of or advice off of social media. And the way things are on social media, those clinical and scientific tend to get conflated, which is where I think a lot of conflict arises. But if you want more detail on that, we have an editorial in the Journal of Clinical Lipidology where we're parsing those two things and working with like cardiologists, lipidologists, saying, look, what we're studying, what we're going to talk about, they are legitimate scientific curiosities. At the same time, don't be stupid and gamble your health if you don't need to.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And I did like that the editorial. I thought you guys laid that position out quite well, and I'm sure we'll get into expanding on just your overall position on it. I'd like to start with that premise of that lower is better, ApoB, all else being equal, as a form of very general on a population level on a mixed diet. I almost want to ask you on a scale of like, don't agree, kind of agree, strongly disagree, or whatever, because I think that's. You guys are proposing within a specific context. It's not so simple, and I'm wondering if you would reiterate that in terms of on a general population level, from in a mixed diet, that all things being equal, lower is better in terms of ApoB.
If you want the soundbite from me, I was going to come with more caveats and lower is better, but like it's at a general population on a mixed diet. Lower ApoB will lower your risk of cardiovascular disease. An exceptionally high ApoB and LDL in the context of a mixed diet would be, for me, cause for concern because I can't think of a single circumstance where the etiology, the underlying driving physiology in a mixed diet population, that would not reflect something negative. It either means you have metabolic dysfunction or you have a genetic condition, as far as I'm aware. Again, in that particular context, for the outcome of cardiovascular disease.
Excellent. And yeah, clip it. No. I'm glad we are beginning with that because that's what makes what you guys are doing so interesting, because it points to there being differences for different populations, given different contexts that can be explained by different things. Go
Can
ahead.
I point out one more thing?
Sure.
And this is people are going to need to listen really carefully here, but I think it's important to dig into. Because I can see even people on quote my side, I know we don't like the whole your side, my side thing, but what people tend to go to is population level data where that actually shows lower ApoB, like very low, is associated with worse health outcomes, including worse all-cause mortality. And that is a true association. But like all things, these come with nuances. So there's a video on my YouTube. I don't know if you saw it, but it was ApoB, LDL, and all-cause mortality. And it was actually breaking down some of these graphs. So there's this one graph where you say like a U-shaped curve where at lowish ApoB is the lowest all-cause mortality, but you go lower and all-cause mortality goes up, which begs the question, is lower actually better for all-cause mortality, which I think we care more about than just cardiovascular disease? And what I kind of do and break it down, the total hat tip here to Professor William Cromwell, because I got these insights from him. He's a lipidologist who we work with. But basically, what we can say is that what predicts death is one thing we can say. What predicts death and what predicts cardiac events can be two separate things. In cardiac events, they don't kill you. Like if you have a stroke and you're, it can not kill you and still have consequences. Same with a myocardial infarction. But in the case of all-cause mortality, there are more dominant things. So it's a matter of a signal-to-noise ratio. In this case, it was a metabolic vulnerability score, which the analogy I use in the video is it's like, all right, If you take a pebble, let's say the pebble is ApoB, and you throw it at a still lake, and it makes a ripple, and that ripple is the effect on all-cause mortality. You can see the ripple. But now, what if you take that pebble and you throw it into a raging ocean during a storm? You don't see the ripple because it's overcome by something more powerful with respect to the outcome of all-cause mortality. And that's the case there. So where you see these patterns that on a population level, say this U-shaped curve, it looks like lower ApoB associates with worse all-cause mortality. I think it's more one a function of the fact that ApoB is not a good predictor of death, but that doesn't mean it's not a good predictor of cardiovascular disease. And two, that there are more powerful things that are confusing the relationship. And in fact, what you find is if you account for these or proxies for these, what you can have this U-shaped curve for all-cause mortality actually linearize. And in that circumstance, when you're doing your best to adjust for these other metrics, then maybe lower ApoB does predict lower all-cause mortality. Again, it is very complicated, and I don't want to take it out of an individual context, but just to layer on that there are nuances here and caution people about jumping to conclusions based on a very superficial reading of the literature. It's like the whole, I mean, people should hopefully know the Dunning-Kruger effect, but the idea of like sometimes it's the people who are very uninformed on the topic that become very confident about that. And the more you learn, the more you realize how many different ways there are to interpret data and how multiple things can actually be true at the exact same time, depending on the lens you're looking at it through.
I mean, I've had a minor Dunning-Kruger effect reading through the lean mass hyperresponder research, so I'm well aware that that can happen. So let's move to that a little bit. If we want to jump back,
Okay.
we can, just in reference. So I'd love for you to define what a lean mass hyperresponder phenotype is, and you could define phenotype while you're at it. And let's just start there.
Let's just say the lean mass hyperresponder group of people.
Sure.
Lean mass hyperresponders are defined by three criteria and only three criteria. They are all lipid criteria. It is a LDL cholesterol of 200 milligrams per deciliter or greater, an HDL cholesterol of 80 milligrams per deciliter or greater, and triglycerides of 70 milligrams per deciliter or fewer. So 200 and above LDL, 80 or above HDL, 70 or below triglycerides. That is the definition. If you have the union of all three of those markers, you're a lean mass hyperresponder by definition. And when I say by definition, I mean we have 10 papers on this topic. There are certain people, I won't name names right now, but are like, oh, there's no literature on this. Like, there are 10 papers. Just because you haven't read them doesn't mean they don't exist. That is the definition. Now, lean mass, where does that come from? It's not in the criteria. It comes from the fact that this triad of markers tends to emerge in lean people on low carb diets. So people tend to criticize that point because like there's no criteria. I'm like, this happens all the time in medicine where it's like there is a name of something and it's appropriately specific and descriptive while not necessarily being true to the word. Another example would be polycystic ovarian syndrome. Do you need cysts in your ovaries to have PCOS? No, you do not. We're fine with that term. Lean mass hyperresponder, it's like not everybody has a BMI below 25. But generally, that population is typified by being lean, and then this triad emerges. In fact, if you do the meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials on humans who are low carb, there is an inverse association between LDL change and BMI. So the leaner you are, the higher your LDL tends to go on population level. So
Could I pause for
with
one
respect
just
to whether or not.
one second here, just to look at those numbers real quick, just for people to reference. So what you're saying is here's a person with what looks like or what is compared to more traditional looking at LDL, really high LDL, incredibly high LDL, over 200, an HDL over 80, also high, but most people are, but well, that's the good kind, and then low triglycerides. And so HDL and triglycerides, getting a thumbs up from your doctor, and the LDL getting a what the fuck's going on scenario. But the that is that that those three markers make up what a lean mass hyperresponder is. But it just so what you're saying is it just so happens that people who have these three markers tend to also be lean people on carb restricted diets.
Yeah, not only that, but like I get a lot of emails of various cases from clinicians because more and more people are becoming aware of our work. Thank you, Oreos. But like I'll get an email from a clinician's like, I had a patient whose BMI, this is a real case, for example, BMI was 43.2. So well into class two, class three obesity range. Their LDL was 80. Just congenitally, they had low LDL. You can have pretty profound obesity and have low LDL. It's totally possible. They went keto, and for months to years, their LDL remained pretty low. It remained 80. They were actually very successful with their weight loss. They reversed prediabetes. They dropped their BMI down into the 20s. And right around 25, something funny happened. Their LDL did a hairpin turn, and it shot up to over 200. So what do you do with that? Let's say you're the clinician treating this patient. It's like, wait, everything was going great, and this person just got to a point where they were too lean, and then their LDL went from 80 to, like, without a change in diet. You know, it's not like they just started, like, they hit a BMI of 26, 25, and then, like, I'm going to trade all the PUFA in my diet for butter. No, it didn't happen. This change is a function of them getting to a lean state. And we see this in individuals. If I gain weight, if I gain body fat, my LDL goes down. If I lose body fat, my LDL goes up. In fact, ironically, the highest LDL I ever had, which is 545. 545, for context, is like, I have told this number to colleagues, including senior attendings at Harvard Medical School. They think I'm joking. They think I'm either mistaken, I'm a silly med student and I didn't read the test right, or that I'm lying, just because they've never seen numbers this high. That is profoundly rare. I can't even, like, you tell a doctor an LDL of 545, they'll be like, nah, this doesn't. So anyway, that happened to me, but it happened under the circumstances. This is the funny part of it was early on in the process. I wasn't sure what the levers were, and I was actually trying to reduce my LDL. So I was on a ketogenic diet and I cut out all dietary cholesterol or almost all dietary cholesterol. There's the only time in my life I was only eating egg whites. Cut out the yolks, wasn't eating any dairy or red meat. But as a function of cutting out those foods, I lost a little bit of weight. So my LDL went up. So again, it presents these weird curiosities, which you see I'm getting animated. This is my scientific mind getting animated. In the moment, I'm like, holy crap, this isn't something I'm comfortable with. As the person who is the subject with that LDL? It's like, I'm not, you can accuse me of, I guess, wanting engagement. People can accuse you of whatever, but it's like, bear in mind where my incentives are. The number one incentive is to not kill myself or not kill family members, including my mom, who's a lean mass hyperresponder too. Like, I don't want to be flippant about these kind of things. But anyway, I forgot even what question I was answering.
No, we're on track here. I feel for the listener, what we're dealing with here is two parallel things. We have a group of people that, by all accounts, barring one, are in good health. You know, HDL looks good, triglyceride looks good. Presumably, other health markers look good. You look at them from the outside; they're active. They're not overweight. But this one marker, LDL, that everybody knows, the bad cholesterol, you know, this thing has now been jacked up. So we have people that are already in that state that have this phenotype, this sort of group of characteristics. And then we have other circumstances, like you said, where people are, again, moving towards greater metabolic health across the spectrum, across a wide range of markers and ways that you would describe metabolic health. But at a certain point, LDL starts to go up and it brings about this confusing question, or this question that I know you're fascinated with, that I am too fascinated with, or I wouldn't have you here. But are these people at less risk for the potential bad stuff that happens from high LDL? Is there something going on in this population that makes that number less bad for this population? And
Yeah.
I know as you're sitting here today, you might have, we're going to get into your position, but I feel like, you know what? I'm not gonna put any words in your mouth. I'd love it for you to just say, "Hey, is that kind of what we're dealing with here?" As a great broad question for this group of this
Yes.
population.
In a word, yes. And I again, that's not heretical to say. It is completely in line with what we know. You're saying, is it possible that this population is at lower risk despite high LDL? And the fact of the matter is, that is definitely a possibility. I'm not saying it's certain, but I'm saying it's a possibility. And let's talk about data that supports that idea and the importance of raising this question. One is just the high-level idea that the physiology underlying the change in a biomarker is relevant. So by analogy, and I'll give you a cardio specific, you know, if you're 6'5" because you have tall parents, right? You're 6'5" because you have tall parents. If you're 6'5" because you have a pituitary tumor secreting growth hormone, you're also 6'5", but the outcomes of those two different physiologic circumstances are going to be different. Now, obviously, there's many reasons it's not a perfect analogy, but I wanted to use that to weigh in to the idea that even with respect to high LDL and by extension high ApoB, etiology and context matter. So there are data, for example, published in JAMA Cardiology showing if you look at different populations with monogenetic familial hypercholesterolemia, so high LDL because of a defect in a single gene versus defect in multiple genes versus no identifiable genetic risk, those people separate in terms of their risk profile despite having similar LDLs. That's been documented. But none of those groups actually speak to what we're seeing here, the lean mass hyperresponder, which is a totally physiologically unique circumstance where the LDL is not going up because of any apparent genetics. Saturated fat, will affect LDL in like most people, but it is not a driving force here. We have a meta of human RCTs to show that leaner is the driving factor. And it does appear to be a metabolic response to carbohydrate restriction that we think is physiologically, at least acutely, adaptive and a change to meet energy demands. So you have a different physiological driver here than ever before. And this is an increase in LDL that is unprecedented. One, well, I mean, in terms of its magnitude, it's not unprecedented. There are genetic conditions, but it's unprecedented in terms of the magnitude, along with the fact that there is no clear genetic driver. So, as in, like, if you have a broken LDL receptor, and it occurs in the context of otherwise good metabolic health. So, this is a population that everybody should be interested in because cardiovascular disease remains a leading killer in terms of chronic disease killers. And this is the first time ever in history we've identified a population where LDL is isolated high without a genetic defect and in the context of good metabolic health. So, talking about the lipid heart hypothesis, this is the strongest human case we've ever had to examine the lipid heart hypothesis, I can't talk, in this way. It's a natural experiment. And I'll just point out, we are now collecting data on risk. And what we found so far in the preliminary data sets, and we can talk about their limitations, is as compared to matched persons with lower LDL, lean mass hyperresponders do not have increase in plaque, and there's no association between LDL cholesterol or ApoB or LDL particle count or even small dense LDL and plaque levels in lean mass hyperresponders. So it does buck a lot of expectations. Those data are preliminary, but they are the first insight we have into this population. So they should be taken with the appropriate level of inquisitiveness.
Yeah, and I'd love to return back to that. That's the keto trial. I'd love to come back to that in a bit of detail in just a second. Just to reiterate, you're essentially saying, hey guys, the reason a marker goes up, and we'll just say it in that context, the reason a marker goes up is relevant to, let's say, the risk of that marker being where it is. And so and I'd love for you to explain, you've coined it the lipid energy model, as to why this is happening metabolically, like what's going on to actually cause. Because I think I'm just sitting with that for a second. I think everybody should that the reason that the marker goes up is relevant to the risk associated with that marker. And so what you're saying is, hey, like this might be an adaptive response to carbohydrate restriction and increased activity and low body fat and all that stuff, which might change how bad this may or may not be.
So I'll explain the lipid energy model, and then I will highlight a distinction which I think you were hinting at, but it's an important one. So high-level lipid energy model posits that when lean insulin-sensitive people go low carb, they are very good at mobilizing fat tissue. And they have a lot of small fat cells. Free fatty acids get released into the blood, and they skyrocket, the free fatty acids do. More so, by the way, than people who have obesity or type 2 diabetes. When you fast or go keto, the free fatty acids go up more when you're lean. Now, that said, what then happens is the free fatty acids need to get kind of re-trafficked around the body through a systemic system that depends on these cholesterol particles. So the free fatty acids will get taken up by the liver. This is our model. There, just want to highlight certain elements of it are still hypotheses. To actually demonstrate all elements of it, I'll need a few more tens of millions, but that aside, the free fatty acids get taken up by the liver and repackaged onto these triglycerides, the storage form of fat, where you have a glycerol backbone and then three fatty acids attached to it, kind of looks like an M. Everybody knows you can't mix oil and water. You can't mix something that's fatty and water. So there needs to be a way to traffic these fats, triglycerides, around the body. They get packaged aboard these VLDL, these very low density lipoprotein particles, these big spheres that are shipped out from the liver and deliver the triglycerides back to muscle tissue and to replenish fat tissue. And they get turned over to these VLDL do by an enzyme, lipoprotein lipase, which sucks the triglycerides out of the VLDL very quickly. So when we're thinking about this triad, the turnover of the VLDL, the sucking out of the triglycerides, will drop the triglycerides. All right, one element to the triad. Now, as you suck the core out of the VLDL, the big VLDL sphere shrinks into a smaller sphere called an LDL particle. And LDLs stick around longer, so your LDLs goes up, while your VLDL actually don't go up. These tend to stay very low. So now triglycerides are low, LDL is high. Where did the HDL come in? Well, when you shrink this VLDL sphere down to a smaller sphere, it loses surface area too. And there's cholesterol in the shell that gets picked up by HDL particles. And so you end up with this triad of the high LDL, the high HDL, and the low triglycerides, which is a manifestation and a metabolic fingerprint, a metabolic signature of what's going on physiologically underneath the lipid energy model. And it's very useful because it's a model that allows us to make certain predictions. For example, if you add back carbs to the mix, then the gas pedal on the lipid energy model is relieved, LDL goes down. All things being equal, if you increase energy demands, what does the lipid energy model say? Flywheel spins faster. Should LDL go up? Yes, in fact, it does. Things like that. So that is the model in a nutshell.
I'm going to do a disgusting oversimplification, just disgusting, disrespectful
Go
oversimplification here. But reducing carbohydrate in a lean, active person increases fat utilization. There's transport of fats to places where it's needed. And during that process, what is remained after the fat is extracted by whatever needs it is an LDL particle that now lives in you for a longer period of time. And at any given point when I'm testing your LDL, because that's what's happening to you to kind of fuel, let's say, exercise or just daily activity or whatever, at any given point, LDL is going to be much, 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 much higher.
Yeah, that wasn't disgustingly over. I mean, here's the thing with oversimplification. Is it still an accurate statement? And I would say, on the whole, your description was accurate. I would just add, though, and you weren't incorrect here, but just to clarify, when we say the LDL particle sticks around longer, I mean longer than the VLDL.
Yes, yes,
In
yes,
fact, I
yes.
think the LDL particle would stick around for less time than a person on a mixed diet or somebody with metabolic dysfunction, which the reason I bring up that nuance is because clearance of LDL particles is relevant. And what we see in lean mass hyperresponders is this high LDL cholesterol, this high LDL particle count, but steady state levels don't necessarily reveal flux. So things could be fluxing through the system really, really quickly, which could have relevance to actually accumulation of plaque or lack of accumulation of plaque. So by analogy, again, you notice I like analogies. If you have a funnel, you can increase the neck of the funnel. You can increase the diameter so water runs out faster and still increase the steady state levels in the funnel if you're pouring in things faster. So one thing that doesn't get pictured in lean mass hyperresponders is what is the degree of actual flux of these particles? And I would suspect they're very, very high flux.
That makes sense. What is the relevance? So the lack of carb restriction is relevant because it means that you are going to be utilizing more fat for fuel. This process is going to be relied upon more. What's the relevance of being lean? And I know that that is a strong point you're making, was, hey, that's not, that is more an association with these markers. It's not necessarily what a lean mass hyperresponder is clinically, but it is what they are in real life most of the time. So what is the relevance of being, normal BMI on the leaner side?
Yeah, I think very high level, leaner people are more able to do this metabolic shift towards fat burning. So we can see this in some of the data with respect to, like, you take a lean person and a person with obesity and you fast them, who has the biggest, bigger increase in free fatty acids? It's the lean person. So it's kind of funny because if you take someone, say, with type 2 diabetes and you look at their steady state, like free fatty acid levels versus a healthy person on a mixed diet, it's a person with diabetes and metabolic dysfunction that has the higher fatty acids. But you can say this almost like kind of flips with a lean person going low carb. They just really get into fat burning mode. And that's been shown in the literature. Now, why it's so profound in lean people and why there almost does appear to be, I mean, your mileage may vary when with respect to BMI, but like a threshold effect. Like we've done AI, machine learning, like decision trees, and weirdly, like BMI 26, 25 does appear to be like kind of a turning point for when this might emerge on a population level. What is mediating that exactly is an like we can observe these relationships and document them when we have. What mechanistically is exactly going on, I'm not sure. It could have to do with signaling from fatty acids. So, for example, this isn't lean mass hyperresponder related, but there was just a paper out in Nature showing that like fatty acids, they were actually using linoleic acid in this study, but can directly bind like as a ligand to a protein called AMPK. The nerds might know what that is, but like can actually modify enzyme activity, not just as a fuel substrate and changing fuel, but like it itself is a signaling molecule, which can then downstream change. It showed in this paper, AMPK signals through this MNKEIF4E axis to change the expression of fat burning and ketone producing genes. So what I'd say high level is that we see this clinically, leaner people, higher jumps in LDL mechanisms. We have biological plausibility. I can't tell you precisely what hormones and signaling molecules are dictating the phenotype.
What's the main, I'm going to ask you to play both sides, but I guess what are the main critiques of this as a hypothesis that you've heard? And I'm sure you've done that because in order to answer the, you want to answer those questions because we want to find out how true it is. So what are the main critiques? And also what do you said you need extra tens of millions. What would be what you'd have to do to confirm how this has happened or the lipid energy model?
So, I mean, a main critique of the lipid energy model is it's a hypothesis. Whoop-de-doo. I know that. We know that.
Interesting.
It's just
not to cut you off. It's just interesting. Like whoever's fighting that battle, that's not a battle I'm as interested in fighting. That's not a battle I want you to fight for me. I'm very interested in the outcome stuff. But like, I just find that interesting. No. Listen, that is a critique. The critique is it hasn't been proven yet. But you're working backwards from an observation of what's happening, trying to reason why it's happening. But I just find that interesting that if the critique is, that it's still a hypothesis. Well, okay, fine. But yeah, go ahead.
There's mental gymnastics around it because it's like, okay, fair enough. It's a hypothesis. I was looking into like a tracer study with one lipidologist. Like, yeah, for 30 people, maybe $2 million. Like,
oh, shit.
I am a young PhD and a fourth year medical student. I do not have $2 million to do this. So put yourself in my shoes for a moment. What would you do from a scientific perspective? What you would do is try to break your model in order to demonstrate its robustness in whatever ways you can. It's kind of what I've been doing. The whole point of like, say, an Oreo versus statin study. We can talk about that, but I predict, so this isn't like retrospective. Like I said, I hypothesize based on our model that I could produce this bizarre finding where I drop my LDL by adding Oreo cookies to my diet. So I'm going to announce that I'm going to do this. Then I'm going to go to Harvard's Institutional Review Board and get an IRB exemption, get my PCP on board and a lipidologist on board, and then execute. And then I'm right. Like, you have to accept that there's something here I might understand that you might want to be curious about, even if the model isn't fully proven, given the limitations of the literature. It's just how science progresses. Beyond just saying this is a hypothesis that's yet to be proven fully, fair enough, I think there's confusions about what claims are being made around the lipid energy model. And this is the clarification that I wanted to offer, which is that what we have here is a mechanistic model of why we think LDL goes up in this particular context. It makes predictions, testable predictions. In that way, I think it's a good model. It's actually been right about a lot of predictions. But I think confusion arises when people think we, or people do who aren't us, say because of the lipid energy model, or let's put it this way, people incorrectly think that the lipid energy model butts heads with the lipid heart hypothesis. The lipid heart hypothesis is a hypothesis, it's called a hypothesis for a reason, about how plaque develops. Lipid energy model is a hypothesis about why LDL is high in lean mass hyperresponders. Those things can very well coexist. And while I think it's totally fair to say if we have a distinct physiological driver, the lipid energy model, it's inappropriate to assume the same risk. That's not saying that even if this is natural and acutely adaptive, there isn't risk associated with the outcomes. And those are all compatible statements that I think some people have a hard time seeing as compatible. Do you know what I mean? Maybe you can rephrase it in a way your listeners might understand a little bit better.
Well, I think that
Because
there's a,
hang up.
yeah, I think there's a misunderstanding that you're explaining it away, almost like explaining the risk away. And I don't think you're explaining the risk away. I think you're explaining why the LDL is going up. And I think there's a separate question of like, what is the risk of this person with this phenotype? And they're
Right.
just two separate questions.
Right. But it's a question. That's the thing, is like we are asking questions. We are not making claims. I am saying, what is the risk of a lean mass hyperresponder? I'm not saying they're at low risk. And those two things are very, very different, but some people hear the question and are offended that we'd even ask the question.
No,
And to
I get it.
that, I take issue.
Yeah, no, I see it, and I sought it out upon my own dive into the research. I sought out those a little bit ruffled by it, and I found it, and it existed. So I want to. It's funny. I have a before we move on, I want to look at some of the research. I don't know if this is your quote that I pulled from the end of the 2022 paper or my summary that I wrote, but we can summarize. We'll do a less disgusting simplification of the lipid energy model, and then we can move to some of the research. I think, all right, this might be your quote. I don't know. The lipid energy model suggests that when you eat fewer carbs and have lower body fat, your body uses more fat for energy, which comes from certain fats in the blood, like VLDL from the liver. As the liver makes more VLDL, the body breaks it down faster, leading to higher LDL and HDL, but lower triglycerides.
I think that was you, but yeah, I think
It'll
it's a good
do.
summary.
It'll do. Let's at risk of going mega long, which I don't mind because I feel like if there was ever a topic to be thorough on and not be misunderstood, it would be this topic because I feel like that's been a story for you guys is the being misunderstood, on a lot of things. You can decide how quickly to breeze through some of these, but I'd love to start with your the introductory paper and maybe there's more before this, but from 2021, just evidence for a lean mass hyperphenotype.
Yeah, so that was the paper that we did with colleagues at Harvard. And it was basically just documenting this phenotype and documenting this inverse association between LDL and BMI, people on low carb diets. Now, the data we had access to, again, it's being opportunistic as a researcher. This was using survey data. So it was limited in like what it was. Which we, laid the groundwork for then doing a meta-analysis of RCTs, which confirmed the findings. But this was our first time documenting in the literature the lean mass hyperresponder phenotype, saying this is what it is. Here's evidence for it. And also, we had a case series that people look at table four in that paper, which was a clinician using the principles of the lipid energy model, basically carb add back, to treat his patients with high LDL with extreme efficacy. I think the first person in that trial, I think their initials were IA or their pseudo initials, and you can ask me why I think I'm right about that. But his LDL dropped, I think, from 665 to 185. And so yeah, I mean, like, even then and today, clinicians are applying principles of the lipid energy model, our knowledge, to our models to treat patients with high LDL who can't afford to come off or to consume carbohydrates. So that was paper one.
Yeah, essentially you saw in this population that the healthier they were, the higher the LDL, and that heavier people saw less of an LDL increase. Presumably they were losing weight.
We've now actually accounted for that in future studies, and like, it's about what weight you're at, not about a weight delta. So, yeah.
Awesome. So that was a pre not preliminary, but that was like proving or being able to identify the phenotype and starting to draw some of these, or at least that inverse association between leanness and LDL. What would you move to next if we were speaking chronologically? Would you go to that 2022 paper, or could we jump to the Oreo paper?
We can jump around. Yeah, the Oreo paper is nice to start a conversation around because it's what people are aware of. And there's a purpose to that. And I like when people bring it up because even though on the surface it sounds frivolous, it's like, wait, what is this N equals one person doing with Oreos and what does this really demonstrate? The point that you or people in general have heard about that, but not all the other literature, is the point of the paper. It was point it, the objective was to do a metabolic demonstration that was extreme but legitimate and get people to turn their heads and go, this is weird. Some people are going to say it's just, media trash. But the fact of the matter is, what happened was we did, or I did, a crossover trial where I had a very tightly controlled, locked-in ketogenic diet. Then I added Oreos to that diet, 12 Oreo cookies per day for about 2 weeks, then did a washout period for 3 months to reset, and then took 20 milligrams of a high-intensity statin, Crestor, for 6 weeks with an IRB exemption from Harvard, with my PCP on board, ordering labs, going directly into my electronic medical record, and with a lipidologist on board. And then we published the findings. So you can like look at all of that. And the fact of the matter is, it doesn't matter if it's an N equals one. The fact of the matter is, this was a predictable outcome, even though it presents itself as paradoxical. Now, I want to be clear. In this paper, I put no value judgment on LDL, but no value judgment on statins. But you know, like any person with a basic emotional intelligence would know how people are going to react to it. They are going to come with their own emotional baggage. And what I really did was just present an uncomfortable tension between here's an unhealthy intervention. I think we pretty much all can agree eating Oreo cookies on top of your standard, whatever your personal diet is not going to be a healthy thing. There was an outcome that is presumed to be healthy. So bad intervention, good outcome. You need to reconcile that. And I do say you, because that is the tension that is implicitly posed. And the reaction could be, oh, I'm going to layer on some value judgment. I'm going to say that Nick is saying XYZ about statins or LDL when I'm not. If you do that, take responsibility for what you're doing. All I'm saying is here's something curious. And what I wanted people to do, and I think a lot of people did, was sit with that curiosity and just say, wow, this is interesting. Now I'm going to go down the rabbit hole. Sounds like you were one of those people, and realize, well, actually, there's a decent body of literature that is also growing behind this. Maybe we should have a discussion. So, long story short, the purpose of Oreo versus statin was to start a discussion, which we are now having.
It was to get you in this seat right now. Like, I mean, not particularly, but it had the exact desired effect of that paper. Ironically, there's papers prior to it and afterwards that I have not seen until reading this one and going down a rabbit hole. So it had exactly the desired effect for the listener. Essentially, you were eating your regular standard ketogenic diet, presumably as a lean mass hyperresponder, had higher LDL, and your intervention was, I'm going to eat more Oreos, and my prediction is my LDL is going to come down because of what we were talking about before, lipid energy model. You're like, hey, I'm eating more carbs, I'm not in ketosis presumably anymore, or much less. And because I'm not in a carb restricted state, I don't have that increase of utilization of fats, and that's going to bring the LDL down. And then you had a washout period. You just stopped, went back to your regular diet to bring LDL back to where it normally is, and then began a separate arm of this study where you took a statin and compared the LDL lowering effect of adding Oreos into your diet, or let's just say adding carbohydrates into your diet. Oreos is good and emotive as a, air quote, unhealthy food, which is smart. Essentially, like, hey, I'm going to add carbohydrates back to my diet. I'm going to watch my LDL go down, or I'm going to see if it is more or whatever comparable to taking, a very popular lipid lowering drug. And again, like you said, and I'm just reiterating that for the listener, myself included, you're like, hey, I added Oreos to my diet. Presumably something that just like you cannot, you can spin contexts in which Oreos are like a helpful food for a certain context, for sure, of course. But very generally speaking, adding Oreos to your diet, not a healthful intervention to your life. And it produced an outcome that by all accounts was positive. My LDL went down. Am I healthier, or was this a net positive, or what does this mean, or how do we look at the benefit of one, the downside of another? And like you said, that is what it was meant to do, is just pose that question of what just happened, and what was that a good thing? What have you seen as like a fallout response to that paper?
Yeah, well, first I'll just say we didn't actually quantify the relative effects. The Oreos were twice as potent as the statin. So the Oreos lowered my LDL 71% in 16 days. The statin lowered my LDL by 32.5% over many weeks. So the Oreos were actually more effective. The fallout has been, okay, there have been some trolls. I'm not concerned about them. People are going to make the jokes. But like you said, it has opened up conversations. I'm having conversations with people outside the low-carb community who have taken the time to get interested and listen and talk, yourself included. I had a 5-hour podcast with Simon Hill. I even sat down with Professor Walter Willett, one of the most cited nutrition researchers in the world, very prominent in the plant-based community. I went to his house. We talked about Oreos. So people are willing to talk about this because anybody who's genuinely scientifically curious about metabolism should be interested in this. This is just interesting. So it has opened up a lot of doors. I will also say maybe an unexpected fallout was the degree to which this is produced clinical results. And what I mean by that is, there have been a lot of people like you, and a lot of them have been clinicians. And when a clinician stumbles upon this, if they have lean mass hyperresponder patients, they now have a different tool to leverage in managing those patients. So there are literally clinicians saying, "Oh, wow, I had this patient, didn't know what they were. Now I know what they are, and I'm not treating with a statin, I'm treating with sweet potatoes." And their LDL has now plummeted probably more than it would have with the statin, and they are happy because they're not on a medication, and I'm happy because their ApoB is managed. So positive results with respect to discussions publicly, clinical results privately, and also collaborations that will hopefully result in more high-grade research in the future.
I'm not doing this, but I'm going to do it for you. That clinician who's treating their lean mass hyperresponder with sweet potatoes, we're not necessarily sure what the outcome of doing so is. So I'm doing that for you because I think that that's a caveat that underpins everything we're talking about here, which is I have a lean mass hyperresponder who's otherwise metabolically healthy, happens to have mega high LDL, but their other lipid profile looks really good. If I give them more carbohydrates and we see the LDL come down as a single independent change, is that what's happening? I don't want to even like put, like, is that am I reducing the risk of heart disease? If so, by how much compared to other interventions that they could do or no interventions? So I just wanted to put that in there because I'm sure that that's on your mind as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's an open question. It's one of those things where it's like that's the art of medicine. You have to make a decision with individual, in an individual context with the information available to you, and sometimes the information is incomplete.
Yep. The question remains. You have a lean mass hyperresponder, by all accounts, metabolically healthy, except for this single marker. You hear words floating around that have come out of my mouth that LDL, ApoB are independent risk factors, and that terminology would imply I don't care about anything else. Blood sugar, I don't care about CRP, I don't care about LDL, I don't care about triglycerides. It's an independent risk factor. So it's not, it's not complicated how you find out about this. You have an intervention, you have a 30-year study, 30-year randomized control trial, and you find out how many people die doing this, and we can't do that though. You can't do that study. It's just like ethically it wouldn't make sense. So what you have is the keto trial, which is, you can speak to it, but we have like basically looking at 5-year plaque progression. My question reading that as somebody just, and I'd love for you to break down just like what that study was, is 5 years enough? And that was a question I just felt unequipped to answer. It's like, what would somebody have expected to happen over 5 years? Is that powerful enough to make a judgment on?
So the keto trial is a 1-year prospective trial. And the 5 years comes in that once we did all the baseline scans for that trial, we were able to match people who were the lean mass hyperresponder group to a match control. And the people on the keto diet had been on keto for 4.7 years.
Gotcha.
Say round up.
Gotcha.
And so we don't actually have a prospective tracking of those people for 5 years, but they were age matched, and LDL prior to the keto diet was actually within 1 mg/dL of the match control group. So it's a presumed exposure increase that comes with caveats. Nevertheless, that's where the 5 years comes from. The trial will include a 1-year perspective, which is actually, given the resolution of CT angiography now, also with AI-guided readings, which we'll be implementing, you can get very fine-tuned quantification. And yes, you can see plaque progression. Even 1-year trials are now becoming more standard. So, yeah.
Speaking to that, I mean, is that what you're looking for too?
For it, you can go to the, PIs and stuff.
Cool. So, is that from a human outcome perspective? Is that something that you're like, yeah, that's ultimately, I know scientific perspective we care about from mechanistic all the way to outcome, but is that ultimately what you think will have to happen before it's adopted by the greater community?
Outcome metrics, you mean?
Yeah.
Not necessarily, no. I mean, like, if you're quantifying plaque progression and you see a certain rate of progression or you see no progression, I mean, like, you don't just have an MI with perfectly fine arteries. So I don't think we need a 10-year study looking at major adverse cardiovascular events and lean mass hyperresponders at scale versus another population to intuit what would happen. Like, I understand there can be a discrepancy between plaque progression and MACE, major adverse cardiovascular events, but I don't think it's necessary to wait to have large scale MACE data before these literature could impact clinical management.
Interesting. Interesting. I'm going to poke around at that a bit. Let's talk about the meta and then let's move and then we can anything else. Let's talk about the meta-analysis. I think that that's one where like I was like, "Oh, I wonder if there's more research on this." I'm like, "Oh, there's a meta 41 RCTs." I was like, "Okay, there's maybe a little bit more here than I expected." Let's talk about that a little bit.
So, this was led by my colleague and friend, Professor Adrian Sotomota, down in Mexico. And basically we did what you said. We did a meta-analysis of 41 human randomized control trials looking at low carb diets to see what are the drivers of high LDL in people who go low carb. And spoiler alert, it was being lean. In fact, if you break up the meta-analyses by category, based on BMI, WHO BMI category, the only group with an increase in LDL is the normal weight BMI. Overweight type 1 class 1 obesity, no increase. In class 2 obesity, you actually see a decrease. And if you look across them, you see an inverse relationship between BMI and LDL change. So very consistent with lipid energy model. And also if you compare it to saturated fat intake, which we had individual participant level data, we could do that. Just being a normal, well, I guess lean BMI, since lean is no longer normal, of under 25, had a more than fivefold predictive effect on LDL increase versus being in like the top fraction of saturated fat intake. So that's not saying saturated fat doesn't affect it, but like the BMI predominated. That was the main finding of the meta.
Was this...
And people love to ignore, by the way. The two most ignored papers we have are the Be Conservative and our JCL editorial and the meta-analysis of RCTs. Those are what detractors love to ignore. You might even know who I'm referring to.
Yeah, no, definitely. This was, the RCT was, like we talked about prior, not... It was accounting for changes in body weight.
Yes, there is an inclusion for that,
and
our lead author Adrian is. I mean, the code's totally available. So we've even had people in like direct messages say like, "Yo, show me the data. Like, give me the code. Here's the code. It's there.
Yeah,
it's linked in the paper. You can go if you use R and look at the code yourself. Play with it. Play with the data. Totally open access.
Is the level of leanness likely? Just a correlate for insulin sensitivity, or is it a correlate for metabolic flexibility here, which is also has a kind of insulin sensitivity as a proxy for perhaps?
I would say the BMI is a proxy for body fat. Obviously like right. People are like, oh, that's another criticism. I mean, you get this all the time. If you use BMI, it's like, why aren't you looking at body fat? I'm like, well, not all these studies that we're looking at
sure.
have DEXAs at
totally.
That point. So yeah, it's just like what we have available to us. We have done one study with body fat and it was predictive, but it probably has to do with signaling from the fat cells, having small fat cells. I don't think it's just a measure of insulin sensitivity. It's energy availability and the nature of the fat cells in that human context.
Gotcha.
Because fat cells are endocrine organs.
Gotcha.
Or fat is endocrine.
Before we move on to giving you the floor to maybe present a take, something similar to your to the JC editorial, any other piece of any of these studies you find particularly like we'd want to speak to?
I mean, we hit the lipid energy model. We hit on the scientific versus the clinical, or A versus statin, the meta. It's a good starting point for one pod.
Cool. Cool. Let's talk about your current stance and outlook. The question, the only question I care about is how at risk is this population? Because I'm ultimately going to be working with a person at some point who has this, you know, clinical triad, these three markers, and is going to want to know if they're at risk or not. And of course, I'm not asking you for a fucking percentage or some sort of very specific risk reduction, if there is any, but just curious where you're at currently as far as communicating the answer to that question.
Yeah. What I would say is our information is incomplete. There is a large body of literature, which we've already, you know, alluded to previously, suggesting that ApoB and LDL particles have a causal role in cardiovascular disease. So all else being equal, reducing levels will reduce risk for cardiovascular diseases specifically. I can't speak to the absolute improvements. It might be zero. It might be 0.001 using arbitrary units here. What I would say is in the data we do have, it doesn't look like a high-risk population yet, which sounds heretical to say, but setting aside the fact that, or accounting for the fact that the preponderance of evidence is not on this population, which is a unique population, the data we do have does not suggest that they're in increased risk. We will have more data outcoming. We have more data that I've seen that are factoring into my response that I can't speak to yet, but will be in upcoming papers. And, you know, what I'd say is it's up to the individual clinician and clinician-patient pair to factor in what new data we have with what caveats, grains of salt they want into how that's going to affect that person's clinical management, accounting for potential side effects and downsides of any given intervention, being that changing diet or pharmacotherapy. I can't do a risk analysis and a pro-con benefit analysis for any individual because I don't know what other factors they're contending with. Long story short, reducing ApoB in this population, I would still presume would reduce cardiovascular risk. I don't know how much. It could be a tiny absolute gain. Is it actually worth it in an individual case? That is not a question I can answer for any individual.
Yeah, what essentially I'm asking is that scenario prior where it's like, oh, this clinician has a lean mass hyper responder client or patient and gives them sweet potato and their ApoB LDL goes down. Like, the question I'd pose you annoyingly, of course, not something we can answer so simply, is that person healthier? Is that person less likely to die, you know, by cardiovascular disease, all-cause mortality, by how much? We don't know, but that's the question that people are going to ask is like, okay, well, that person who doesn't add Oreos, they add sweet potato and fruit and, you know, whole grains. And
if they can.
Right. You mean if they can?
So if I was in that position, I would. I can't because I have a therapeutic need.
Totally. My follow-up question is, if we can't speak to that, to any single specific individual, because we don't know other things that they might be going through that, again, downsides to a specific intervention, or not even downsides, just other things that could happen. Let's talk directly to a general population of lean mass hyper responders who hear this, and I'm sure your fans, we've talked about air quotes, like maybe a bit bullish on there's no risk, I'm not at any risk, it doesn't matter, I'm fine. What would you recommend to that person? What would you suggest to somebody who is a lean mass hyper responder? Best practices. How do you do this the most intelligent way? What can I do to mitigate my risk if, you know, for this population?
I'm actually going to divert because I feel like I've already rendered my opinion on what I would do and what one could do to potentially adjust risk. What I would say, because you're asking me to talk to my quote fans, is that if you've listened to the podcast up until this point, or you just follow me in general, actually read the papers, actually see how I and my colleagues speak about this topic, if you notice a discrepancy between how you're talking about it, I mean, sure, you're entitled to your own opinion, that's totally fine, but bear in mind the extremists who present positions that aren't actually defensible. You're not helping, you're creating an obstacle, because then I have to contend with the stigma that is generated around studying this phenotype, which makes it harder to build partnerships, harder to get resources to do research. So this is definitely a circumstance where softer, more reasonable voices will get the research that you want done more quickly, more efficiently, with more rigor, and with more money behind it.
I agree, and I said this to you off air that I've appreciated both in your social media content, YouTube content, but also maybe even more importantly in the scientific literature at large on this topic. The conservative, and I say conservative, I just mean truly scientific word choices, which is not overly speculative, not jumping to conclusions, you know, taking it one step at a time. And I know that that's almost condescending to say to somebody who's very qualified, but I see a wide array of maybe speculative language within the scientific research sometimes, and just sometimes it can just gloss right over you and you're reading it and you're nodding along. But I really did appreciate that even somebody who, yeah, maybe I don't know, maybe behind closed doors feels strongly, has speculation, you know, but in the research, whatever, you don't need my vote of confidence, but it seems like you guys are going about it the right way and trying to really help people with this, not necessarily just be like, yeah, there's no risk, everyone's good, LDL doesn't matter anymore. And so I really appreciate that, and I thought it came through in all of the studies and in the editorial as well.
Thank you.
So other questions I need to ask. Hold on, let me browse. Maybe you know this specifically, or maybe we don't know it specifically. What percentage, again, rough percentage or actual percentage, of people who are on a carb-restricted diet and lean are lean mass hyper-responders?
A study that we're currently designing at the moment to test that. I don't know prospectively what the penetrance of the phenotype is, as in, if I were to select, because this is actually something we call the gym hypothesis. I think my friend Adrian coined it, but it's been something me, Dave, and Adrian have been talking about for a while, where like if we went to a gym and just visually looked around, like, we think we could turn you and you and you and you and you into a lean mass hyperresponder. And we collected these people and we could control them, even though they've never been low carb before. We could control their diet and lifestyles. I would be, you know, I am making this number up entirely, completely speculating. I'm going to guess it's not 100%, but I would say upwards of 70%. I do think this is a metabolic phenomenon. It could have permissive genetics, as in some people have certain genetics that don't permit the phenotype to emerge, but I don't know the exact percent. We have to do that study to do right, probably in the order of 1.2 mil. Because what we want to do is look at what predicts conversion and what occurs with conversion in a comprehensive multi-omic manner, ideally in a feeding trial setting over a long enough period of time. It's not an easy thing to do.
Yep. How much do you think activity plays a role, if at all?
I think it's important. I think having a certain, like, I don't know many lean mass hyperresponders who are close to sedentary. A lot of them do have like elevated energy needs. And so, yeah, it seems relevant. And also increasing energy output will, in a lean mass hyperresponder, tend to increase LDL. And of course, if you take the extremes of like ultra marathon runners, there are at least cross-sectional studies showing that like an ultra marathon runner on a low carb diet will have a much higher LDL than an ultra marathon runner on a higher carb diet, even if that low carb diet isn't conventionally keto. It's close to like 80, 100 grams of carbs. But again, their energy demands are just so high, they're also burning through those carbs, that they can still manifest lean mass hyperresponder physiology.
Gotcha. When we look at attempting to play both sides here, what are some of the best critique/important questions being asked? Slash pushback you're getting? And I wrote four that maybe somebody could say, and I'd love for you to add and subtract to the list. One would be, we don't have long enough research, or enough research. It's such a tiny percent of the overall population, but I think that, again, this is a fallacious argument because you're not trying to extrapolate it to the greater population at large. So yeah, it's, you know, you guys are making a big stink over a tiny, tiny percent of the population, but I don't think you're extrapolating to the greater population at large, unless I have that wrong.
No. So on the first point, we need more long-term research. Great. Do you want us to just sit on the research and hide it behind closed doors while more research is coming out? Like, no, like, we have the research we have. Say, oh, but I want a 10-year study. I'm like, all right, wait 9 years and we'll have it for you.
Right.
Sorry, that's how like time works. And then the whole small population thing, it's like, I don't even know the term you use, a big stink out of a small population. It's like, what we're doing here is asking scientific questions about a very interesting phenotype. And all the time in medicine, we're looking at like weird outliers, and we learn things from those weird outliers, be they humans with familial hypercholesterolemia, homozygous FH, be those Gila monsters and lizards with weird venom that you study in the 90s. It turns out that's the, predecessor to the GLP-1 class of drugs. It's about being a curious intellectual, pursuing interesting observations, and then getting answers that can inform innovation and help broad populations. So I'm not trying to change the clinical management of the population with respect to LDL. I'm trying to answer and ask with my colleagues interesting questions about this really cool thing we're observing. And if we're right, and this speaks to general underlying human physiology, the information that is revealed could be helpful to the entire public.
The other two would be, oh, all these people would be healthier if they ate carbs to bring down ApoB. They'd be, that you are healthier in your Oreo scenario.
No, I will tell you that's a fallacy right now because there are people that if they reintroduce carbs, you're going to have IBD flares or more seizures. That is not healthier. That is no quality of life. So I can refute that off the bat pretty easily.
Sure. The counter to that would be, okay, I'm not talking about those people. I'm talking about other people who are doing keto voluntarily as a I like it better. I feel better. I can be more consistent with this sort of approach, et cetera.
I would say it's very possible that that would reduce their cardiovascular disease risk. We don't know by how much. We don't know the absolute risk reduction. And I mean, all I have to say on that, other than that, is like, live and let live, I guess. I try to speak as carefully as possible and not give wrong impressions. But at the end of the day, I do believe in individual choice. And so if a person has chosen not to take a medication or intervene to lower their ApoB, and that is their choice, they need to live with the consequences. I need to live with the consequences, quite frankly. I've made a calculated decision based on all the factors in my life, and I'm not on pharmacotherapy right now. If something negative happens, I have no one to blame but myself. So, I'm walking the walk. I'm not just talking the talk.
Sure. Another critique would be, again, vague. Long-term, air quote, Paul Saladino interjects with long-term ketosis probably isn't best long-term anyway, so this doesn't really matter because insert hormones, insert electrolytes, insert, I don't know what his arguments are, but again, I don't even need you to speak to that one because as it came out of my mouth, I put it firmly.
I'll just say it's like the whole idea of it may not, I'm like, it may not, and it may be perfectly reasonable. I do think there is something, so at a high level, to like cyclic catabolic and anabolic phases, fasting and feeding, including like fasting from carbohydrates and refeeding. There's something about that that does make sense. Biology works on cycles. Refeeding, including with carbohydrates, could have, positive anabolic effects, in systems throughout the body, including the brain. One can speculate. But at the end of the day, it's about what the person wants to do that makes them feel well. So, taking this into real world context, some people do very well on ketogenic diets for different conditions, be it mental health conditions, epilepsy, neurological disorders, autoimmune inflammatory disorders. We can speculate about under, optimal conditions, would periodic carb refeeds be beneficial? Maybe. But for those people or people dealing with conditions where ketogenic diet is therapeutic, then I say, do what keeps you healthy as an individual. So I think it's fair speculation. I just don't think it's all that relevant when it comes down to it.
How carb restricted does one need to be? Is being in ketosis as per a specific level of blood ketones relevant?
I would say you do need, if I were to create numbers, it's going to be somewhat arbitrary numbers. I mean, I would say like
More
below 50
generally.
grams per day or something. But again, it depends on your activity level, how big you are. Stuff like that. And in terms of absolute levels of ketones, the thing is, if you're long-term keto adapted and also eating more saturated fatty acids, those things are going to conspire to give you lower relative ketone levels. So you could be a lean mass hyperresponder with ketones of 0.2 or 0.3 millimoles. The ketone level is not a perfect proxy for how much you're actually burning fat.
I had never been, dude, I went zero carb and couldn't get ketones above like 0.2, 0.3. Like just could not. It just didn't happen. So that's a
Yeah,
fair,
everybody's different.
yeah, that's a fair
And you got
point.
to learn your body. Like there are ways I can get my ketones up to six,
Sure.
but if I do carnivore, my ketones don't bump above like 0.3 or 0.4, even after a 24-hour fast from pure carnivore. So yeah, answer that question.
Yeah. I want to marinate on a couple of other questions before I pose them to you, but we'll get you out of here on the on a topic around what just what's next. Like what's you're clearly continuing to, like we said, research this and develop new ways of just filling in gaps and answering questions that both you have and others. So what are you guys working on right now?
I don't think I can actually speak to exactly what we're working on. I don't think I'm allowed to, but we are working on both mechanistic and clinical risk studies. And what I can say is the resources we have to do these studies are increasing with time, which is what we expected. So this is a space to watch. I think we're kind of at a catalytic moment. I will say I'm allowed to say that the data on the prospective portion of the keto CTA study is collected and complete. And so people can expect to see that manuscript hopefully in the coming months for more data there. Beyond that, I mean, where I am personally is I spent the last, well, actually, what, like 11-ish years of my life in higher ed, and I'm kind of coming to the end of that whole undergrad through MD PhD saga, figuring out what I want to do with my life. And part of that is definitely going to include more public relations. So people are going to see a lot more of me, especially after I graduate. So I graduate Harvard in May, and I'll be done with that MD PhD, and I'll continue to be more vocal. But it's something I really appreciate, the opportunity to speak with broad audiences. And I think it is a fun skill to practice and hone. So to those listening, I appreciate people listening to this point in time, because a lot of times people don't take the time to actually hear people out. But whereas I think a lot of, quote, influencers, now I'm losing my voice, influencers in the space kind of have differentiated and have their shtick, have their way of being, I like to think that I am acutely aware of where I am in this stage of development, and with an intention to be a public presence for the next half century or so, having just started, I'm 28 now, like I really do take feedback when posed thoughtfully seriously, and like when people present it, because it helps me evolve my position, how I articulate things, and I take people's feedback as my own data. And so, you know, there's the metabolic scientist in me, and there's also like me performing these social experiments, right? Oreo versus statin, 720 eggs, where it's like,
yeah,
what's going to resonate with people, and how can I hook them in to actually think and learn and be curious? And that's what I'm really passionate about. Well beyond lean mass hyperresponders, I have a lot of other interests too. But like it's about sharing that passion and curiosity for science and metabolism, and just getting people like thrilled about it. Because I think that intellectual engagement and mindset around metabolic health is an incredibly potent tool for improving your own metabolic health, whatever your journey may be.
Yeah, at some point in some piece of content, you spoke about maintaining the awe around science, and I'm waiting for other people I consider scientists to pick up on the awe in this scenario, which is kind of odd. And so I think that there's, you know, you can only talk about calorie deficit so much, like before, like why isn't this something that is super fascinating and has, I don't know, caught people's interest? People much larger than me and larger than you in this space. It's a bit bothersome, and it has affected me a little bit in the last week or so. Why has this been my foray into this literature, and why hasn't it been something, you know, we can talk about? We won't need to name names, but big names have made videos about the Oreo study, and yeah, where is the intrigue? Where is the diving into? Obviously, that is a paper has its own inspiration and its own purpose, but yeah, I'm just slightly disappointed that it's not something that's at least being discussed by, I don't know, larger accounts. Other people I would hope would have that same awe.
So just now I'm going to put you in the hot seat. Name your top five. If you wanted me to, if you said to five people listening right now who might listen to you or might be responding to a reel on Insta, You should have a conversation with Nick around these phenomena. I'm curious as to who your list of five would be.
Yeah, Lane would be up there for sure. And I know that that's somebody that you guys have spoken to in the hopes of bringing to the table. Atiyah is on that list as another person I have seen you guys hope to maybe bring to the table in some way. And then I know you guys have had corresponded in some way. Yeah, Nadolski's an interesting one. Again, I'm picking names I know that you have mentioned, but I'm not so sure that is somebody in this context, actually. I think he has his own way of, I don't think he doesn't strike me as somebody who's making content out of like intellectual curiosity. I haven't gotten that vibe. He's not someone who's like breaking down studies every day and like just more of a on the meme side of things, which whatever. But I'd love to see. I mean, listen, this is what I was telling my wife before. I was like, I'm the wrong person. I'm the wrong person to have. You know, Simon Hill is the right is one of the people, maybe one deviation back from interacting with the science. But I'm the wrong person. I was like, I'd love what we need is more of podcasts with you and Simon Hill, where there's somebody who's even more than Simon. I think Simon's got a huge audience and incredibly knowledgeable. But would love to see. You sit down with Lane or Peter Attia and people who have are going to ask questions and in a way that's going to actually bring this to the greater population at large.
Thanks. Obviously, the offer is open for both those individuals. I won't comment beyond that right now, but yeah, those would be fun discussions, and I actually think they'd be very fruitful discussions. Not ones that require any victory lapping or contention. I think people listening up until this point, if they do follow those individuals, you can reflect on like how they might think that it might be a controversial discussion, or that they like what I've tried to say more to Lane than to Peter. I've had very infrequent correspondences with Peter, just one or two, through a medium. But you'd be surprised about what quote concessions you could get out of me. I don't even want to call them concessions because they're not changes of positions. The positions I've had all along. But it's about platforming nuance and what we're actually saying versus amplifying caricatures of what you think we are, either intentionally or unintentionally. I know at least in one circumstance, it was done quite intentionally, overlooking things like the meta of RCTs, our JCL editorial, et cetera. Nevertheless, if you are truly not only scientifically curious, but passionate about not just getting clicks from your viewers, but bringing them up to speed on the literature, then it would behoove you to have these conversations. So I honestly think both those conversations will happen over time. It just might take a little bit of time for certain people to warm up given certain histories. So.
I don't. I'll wrap up with. I'm not so sure anything that you have said that I have read or listened on a YouTube or anything has been particularly contentious. I think you're just going along with what the research is showing and posing questions that are completely and utterly legitimate. I'm sitting here as somebody who's coming from maybe consuming a bit more on that side of the content, but incredibly intrigued by what you guys are doing and. Just, I'm also just interested in the answer to the question of like, are these people at a greater risk? Is I have people that go keto that come to me that have crazy high LDL and have been told previously, all right, well that you should make modifications to your diet to bring your LDL down, even though you feel great and everything else is going great. And I think that there's, man, if all that can happen is we can give people another way of living a happy, healthy life, and that this can be a route for people if. It is reducing risk in a net positive way, and that's awesome. I mean, that personally, that I my only dog in the fight is, will this information ultimately help me help a specific individual? I know other people may feel like they have other things that they do, but yeah, I'm interested because I know that there will be people I'll come into contact with who this can be a viable option for them, and I hope that more research elucidates the truth to that question.
Yeah, agreed.
Cool. All right, man. You've been super generous with your time. I'll tag you in everything. You gave me a bunch of links. I'm going to link all the studies. If there's anything else that I miss, you'll let me know and I'll put it in the show notes.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Jordan.
Nick, where can people learn more a bit about you? About what you guys are doing, all your stuff.
You can find me at Nick Norwitz, NicNorwitz. Basically on any social. There's not another Nick Norwitz on the planet that I'm aware of, so I'm easy to find. For a list of our papers, if you go to nicknorwitz.com, is a publication page there. It's like 40 papers there you can review. I'm really enjoying doing YouTube breakdowns on all sorts of different things. This morning's was on bile acids binding receptors in the brain affecting depression. Where the last one was on lactate in the brain affecting anxiety. So like I genuinely enjoy like reading Cell Science and Nature and then trying to figure out ways to communicate it. So if you like the kind of stuff, I try to keep them to like around 10-ish minutes. But yeah, engage with me. Like I said, I'm generally new to social media and very, very happy to get feedback and evolve. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.